This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Frida Liu. It's Enterprise, yes, and I've got the folks from Digital News Asia here. We've got Chong Jin Seong and Zof Asmi, who has been on with us at DNA. No, he came on another hat.
It was for DNA,
but it was
a one-off special appearance.
And I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more from him and Karamjit Singh if and when he turns up. Of course, what we do here is we talk about the tech space, the tech ecosystem and all that. Jin always have all these fun stuff, like where he's reviewing all the great, latest gadgets and all that. And this is Xiaomi's Redmi Note 5. Tell me about that story.
So the Xiaomi Redmi Note 5 is one of a long line of, I wouldn't call them budget, but actually they are kind of like budget range. So at the price range you're getting at this end of the spectrum, you expect that, you know, the most of the features of the phone will not be quite up to par as what you expect from your high-end Samsungs or your iPhone even. But Xiaomi is going really aggressive with the Redmi Note 5, notably during the launch last 2 weeks ago. So like they were mentioning that, you know, this has practically everything you could want in a flagship phone, but at a price point. So would you care to take a guess how much this may cost?
Ooh.
I mean, I'm holding in front of you now, so
okay.
This is the phone.
Oh, he's doing a test on me. Okay, so
yeah.
I will do, okay, how it feels, you think it'd be like in the one grand plus.
Okay.
But are you saying that it's less than one grand?
It's less than that, actually.
$699. Okay.
Or beginning at $799,
oh,
actually.
Serious?
So actually, this is a pretty affordable phone, I would say. Oh. So it has really, you can see it's got a, well, you can't see it on the radio, but you can, feature can see.
Yeah,
it's got a really big screen. This is almost 6-inch in size. Sorry, 5.8-inch. The camera at the back looks practically like an iPhone. It's got the two cameras at the back. You've got a fingerprint reader. I don't know what else you really need in the phone these days, because practically all phones more or less feel the same. But I have to say, while testing this out, the camera actually is not bad. It's actually a 12 megapixel camera and a 5 megapixel. Snap. So basically, Xiaomi is putting this at high up. Actually, during the presentation, they call this as high up as even Samsung's Galaxy S9, even saying that the number of pixels on this it captures is just as high as that. So, like, and to be truthful, I've been trying out for the past week or so, and actually, it's pretty good, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, for the price point you're putting it at, and Xiaomi themselves, they're being really aggressive.
Mm.
I talked to their South Pacific region manager, head of Xiaomi South Pacific region, Stephen Shi.
Mm.
So I talked to him on what their strategy was coming to Malaysia, and they already opened a few stores already. I think about 3 to 4 stores last year. And this month alone in May, they're opening 6 stores, if I'm not mistaken, in Penang, Johor, Malacca, Kota Kinabalu, Alostar, and Klang. Well, Klang being a slang off, but nevertheless, they're quite aggressive pushing out their products to all these stores. And it's part of a wider ecosystem of products, because they don't only just make phones.
Right.
They're making, you know, your dashboard cameras, your rice cookers, your weighing scales, all these elements they're trying to build into one smart ecosystem. So it's quite interesting that, you know, they're making it out that these phones don't necessarily mean that you need to fork out a high price to enjoy, you know, good quality premium products, I would say. But the results have made to be seen, so I really try out for sure in the review.
So, if you take out the price range and everything, I mean, it just is pretty good. It's just like, and then so the fact is, the bonus is that the price range is an added advantage.
I would say it puts it within anybody's reach right now. I mean, like you and I, anybody practically, it's just at $799, even if you want the lower configuration with this, slightly less memory and stuff you can put in. But otherwise, I think it's okay. I mean, you want a secondary phone, I think this could usually stand in as one. Not to be biased or anything, but I think it really, I'm quite impressed with the features that come in. And the last phone I tested from them, the camera was horrible. And now it's like, I'd say they've really upped their game.
So a real marked improvement from the last launch.
Yeah.
So this is, of course, the one of the things they also have is the band.
The fitness band.
The fitness band as well. So which moves in very nicely with the next story about Fitbit.
Fitbit, yes.
They debut with their new Versa smartwatch.
Yeah.
T- help? Are you wearing it?
Yes, I am.
He's fully equipped, man. All right. Okay.
Well, to get the best of it, you have to really try it out for yourself. But the Fitbit Versa is practically like a... I would say, actually, it reminds me of... have you heard of the... oh, goodness me, I forgot the name now. But there was previously another brand... Pebbles. So previously, there was a brand of smartwatches called Pebbles.
Yes.
They were very simple, small. Mm. And actually, the Versa reminds me a lot of a Pebble. Mm. By virtue of its size, its square in shape, it's nowhere as big or fancy as, say, an iWatch, I would say. But then it's the interface and the feeling of it reminds me of a Pebble. And incidentally, Fitbit bought Pebble about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So perhaps some of that is bleeding in into their ecosystem. So
yes, you would, right? I mean, otherwise, why the buy the company?
Yeah, I mean, they want the expertise in it.
So this one, right, again, they've never had a similar kind of smartwatch before?
They have actually launched one earlier this year called the Ioniq.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in January this year. That is a higher end model than this. I believe this one also retails at 999 for the base version of it. 990. Mm. That's the base version of this. So I would say, actually, to be honest, Fitbit and the spectrum of smart devices, they're the higher end.
Mm.
Like the earlier you mentioned about the Xiaomi, that is on the entry level ends by 100 ringgit.
Yeah,
so this is, you can buy nine of those practically with this. But with this, you're paying for more accurate heart rate monitoring.
Mm.
You're able to monitor your sleep. When you're sleeping, it's able to like tell you, you know, how's the quality of sleep. And they're adding also, this is for ladies, they're able to track your cycle.
Your cycle.
So that is a coming feature that's not in yet. But they're saying that this one, that is actually a special mode for ladies that you can actually track and even predict your cycles in a month. So that is part of it's a lifestyle device actually that is, you know, trying to... more than just, you know, tracking your exercise, how your routine is, how well you're doing, but also how well, you know, other aspects of your life.
So you've been using it for a week as well?
Yeah, about a week. I would say that I have a mixed bag of feelings about it because I've used the products before.
Right.
I don't feel it's too different. The only benefit is that I get to see all the information on the watch. Because previously I was using another version of their watch called the Alta HR, and that was a slim display that you have to, you know, like your stock ticker, you have to wait for the message to scroll through. So this is like, okay, I read it and it's there, and it's like a lot more convenient. So that's the added benefit. But aside from that, I find it's like pretty much the same like any of the other fitness trackers out there.
The one that you talked about, the one that was launched beginning of the year, the Ioniq, what was that price range like?
I think it's definitely above 1,000 ringgit. That's definitely above 1,000. Oh, and one added benefit is that you can swim with this.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can swim at 50 meter depth. So that's pretty much all your swimming pools and everything. You can just take in for a swim. So basically covers everything. You want to run, you want to cycle, you want to swim.
I might want to consider getting one of those. Okay.
Yeah,
all right. So that's the smartwatch and all that. Karamjit Singh has just joined us. Glad that you could join us.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to move away from this for a while and talk to Zof, right? And you've got an exciting story on quantum computing. And I understand that Karam told me he had a migraine editing it. Well done. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm so sorry.
Especially you're grasping the word qubit.
Oh yes,
which
qubit.
I kept thinking qubit, but so that's how low tech I am, lah. Should I be admitting that on air?
I think Karam, it's not fair, lah. You're making it sound. So yes, it was an article about quantum computing, and I talked to Professor Joseph Fitzsimmons or Fitzsimmons. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but he's from the university in Singapore, and his specialty is quantum computing. I suppose, have you ever heard of this thing called quantum
computing? I have.
Do you know it's this strange and wonderful world that is completely different from the way computers work these days?
Okay.
And one of the incredibly challenging things is to explain why it's different. I think you must take it upon some faith that it is different, and then I can probably spend half an hour explaining why it's different and probably get half of it wrong. But
no one will know.
Oh, somebody will know. I mean, on this radio chat, on BFM, somebody will know. But the analogy I use is that quantum computing is different from normal computers in a similar way that a microwave oven is different from a conventional oven. Mm. So they look the same, like they both look as if, like both ovens look as if they cook food. But microwave ovens work in a completely different way. Mm. And that's the same with quantum computing. It works in a completely different way. As a result, certain things which are very hard to do on normal computers suddenly become very easy. Mm. And that one category of thing that concerns people a lot is that most of cryptography as we know it right now, mm-hmm. which is very difficult to crack on normal computers, becomes very easy to crack if you have a working quantum computer. Mm. How easy is it to crack? Generally speaking, cryptography should be easy to encrypt, but very difficult to crack. Mm. On a quantum computing, the order of difficulty of cracking these algorithms is on the same level as encrypting it. Mm. So if encrypting it takes you 5 seconds, then decrypting it using a cracking it using quantum computer will take you 5 seconds as well. Oh. This is a very rough. So you can see why people are worried about it, because most of the internet is based on this.
Okay. Almost all, yeah. So, and I think in the article also, oh no, in my week in review, I mentioned that I was in IBM. I was a guest of theirs in 2016 in March. Mm. And then we were in New York, so we went to the Yorktown, you know, research center. And then they brought us, you know, media into this room where there was actual working, you know, quantum computer. And like it was taller than my 1.93 meter height. Mm. Yeah, and it was not very wide in terms of its width, but it was long also, like over 10 feet long. And you had this bizarre, and you couldn't take pictures, right, of course. But it had these incredible tubes and valves, you know, running in and out of it. It looked like the early pictures of computers we saw, you know, back from the 40s, right? Mm-hmm. Where an entire room, no exaggeration, this model looked like that. It was incredible. And it's just so powerful. And these guys are also super smart. You listen to them after 3 minutes and you get brain cramp just trying to...
That's why he covered this story and not you.
Exactly, man. There you go. You didn't have to rub it in. But hey, I was at Yorkston, man. How about that? You can't say that.
No, I mean that's the thing, right? Because quantum computing has gone from speculation back in the 80s to, well, you know, this like, oh, maybe we can try to build a quantum computer. And what happened in March of this year was that Google announced that they're building a 72-bit qubit quantum computer. And of course, if you don't know what a qubit is, that number means nothing.
Yeah.
But just to say, theoretically speaking, a 50-qubit computer would be on par with the most powerful conventional supercomputer today.
Wow.
So a 72-qubit, if it works the way they hope it will work, would exceed that. Now, and it's not easy to compare because they're two different things.
Animals,
so when you say it's on the same power, you have to sort of explain what that means. But yeah.
And here you was thinking it's qubit, huh?
All right.
No, it helps me remember the term. Like, it's a new term, right? Which even in all my readings in tech, I don't come across this at all. So, and of course, when you see a headline, an article with, you know, talks about quantum computing, you just I just don't read it because it's like too far away. You think, right? But now, you know, it's not as far away as we think it is. Mm-hmm. At least the early models, working models.
I mean, you have to do something. So very quickly, just to finish off, you obviously have to do something about it. The NSA last year released an advisory saying you've got to start considering encryption methods which are not susceptible to being hacked by a quantum computer. And one of the things that Joseph said was that all the stuff you have in archive that you thought was secure because it's encrypted. You have to start thinking, what if next 5 or 10 years is no longer right?
And by the way, NSA is National Security Agency. Listeners know.
Yeah. Okay, we'll continue with other stories after this. Chong Jin Seong, Karamjit Singh, and Zof Azmi. Stay tuned to Enterprise BFM 89.9.
Building first world mindsets. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Enterprise. Good morning, Frida Liu here. Chong Jin Seong, Karamjit Singh, and Zof Azmi from Digital News Asia. We're talking about the tech ecosystem here. We talk about quantum computing, Xiaomi and Fitbit and all that. You've got another story, Zoff, and this is a story on digital wallets. And you attended, GEM event last Thursday on this?
Yes, so GEM is the global entrepreneurship movement, mm-hmm. and they do these regular... Monthly
GEM.
GEM, as in the jewel.
Okay.
And they always pick a different topic, and the one that they did last week was on e-wallets. Mm. And I felt the most interesting takeaway from this is that the whole ecosystem and the players seem ready for e-wallet to explode on the Malaysian market, but the end users may not be so there yet, as it were.
I was there also, right? I came towards the last 20 minutes or whatever, and then I think at the end they asked a question about how many of you, you know, would use or are using, you know, e-wallets.
Actually,
and then
less than half. Do you guys?
No, just not yet.
I have cryptocurrency and I don't have e-wallet.
Okay. I don't know whether Faith is considered, but then they just say, is it considered?
Yes.
Faith,
so
yeah, of course.
I'm trying to use it a bit more, but I don't think I park all my cash in it. They don't quite hold value like certain e-wallets, like your BigPay and stuff like that. I don't think it does.
So until there is value, then you probably would.
You could. And over half the audience said they don't use or they wouldn't consider using it. So that's, and this is, I would think, a very... You know, a very savvy and very clued in crowd. Over half of them said, and they are nobody is embarrassed or whatever. There's no value yet, right? Mm. So, very interesting. But there's a KK Mart near my neighborhood just opened up, and they have Mcash, and that's apparently their own, you know, a wallet. And I'm looking at that. Yeah, you got Alipay next to it, Mcash. And I'm going to already have a wallet anyway, you know. I'm going to try it out. You have to, right? Mm. To see how convenient. And every time I go to a store where I see these signs there, I ask the cashiers, are people using it? I was at Ali Iksan the other day. Mm. CIMB has partnered up with Alibaba also, right? Alipay. So there's a CIMB, you know, Alipay sign there. And I said, have people started using? She said, other. There was Samsung Pay also. Samsung Pay, not so much, interestingly enough, although they were there earlier. But Alipay is, together with CIMB, is picking up. And then even Fave also, I hear people now using it. And by the way, Fave sent a press release out that they said that by the end of this year, they expect to have transacted 100 million US, you know, with merchants over their Fave Pay. So it's but that's regional, not just in Malaysia, because that's their regional company based out of Malaysia. But it is picking up. How fast? I don't know, but you know, it is moving.
I'm watching my own behavior, like when I'm looking.
Really?
At I see it there, and I still it's not part of my DNA yet.
That, so you already started noticing it, right? Yeah.
Certainly from Bank Negara's perspective, and their representative was there. They really want to push Malaysians to use digital or online transactions, digital currency or online transactions. They don't really want people to use cash or even checks, because there's a cost to cash. One of the
panelists
said.
I still have my checkbook.
I was actually watching a movie, a TV series the other day, which I seldom do, but then, you know, the scene was at a fundraiser, and this is a show from the 2017 season, and then the guy was saying, be generous with your checkbooks. And I'm saying, hey, this is a 2017, right? And it's a show based out of the US, Hollywood, coming out. Still checkbook. So very interesting. So even there, you know, it's not in the terminology yet. But it's going to happen for sure. But, you know, by the way, I think I mentioned this on air before. Sweden is actually looking to maybe legislate that you cannot just totally use e-money. The central bank is worried about. Because if you go too fast, a lot of people who are in older generations, like 60 and above, just don't want to use that money. And smaller communities and all, there's no need for that yet. So they're worried that these people will fall between the cracks in your rush to be, hey, we're first to digital, and there'll be a high social cost to pay for that.
I think
the day
when we can say we can go out without cash and feel all right, that's the day.
Fantastic,
right?
Very good,
Because you still can't go out without
Frida, you have you have credit cards, you have debit cards.
It's the little things that are still not part and parcel.
Yeah. Your pisang goreng.
Not only that, maybe sometimes the parking doesn't have
of course,
touch and go or whatever. Yeah. Then you
most
still need.
Most parkings don't.
Right. So these are the. So until you say I can go out without thinking I have to use cash, that will be the day.
I think that's a 10-15 year journey before we reach that psychological state, I think.
Because one thing the panel didn't really discuss, because the question came quite late in the panel, they didn't really discuss why really there was such a strong resistance. The CEO of InTouch & Go, oh my God, this name slips
away. I think it's a Karamjit disease, you know. because I can't remember the name. I can't help you guys.
My childhood friend says the Karamjitisis.
While Karamjit's doing that, I was trying to scroll down. Sharunizam Samsudin, CEO of Touch & Go, shared. He said like more than half, 51% of people who use LRTs don't use Touch & Go. They pay for a token. And this is despite the fact that using Touch & Go gives you a discount regularly. And if you travel before 7 a.m., it's like a 50% discount if you Touch & Go. So he also is not certain why is it that there's such a resistance.
Speaking of wallets and money and all that, iPrice Group releases their Q1 28 findings on Malaysia's top 50 e-commerce sites. Who are they, Jin?
iPrice is basically like a price comparison site, actually. Mm-hmm. So you get to compare, what is this phone and how much it is spread across the different e-marketplaces that you find online. So interestingly, they released the Q1 top 50, and no surprise that Lazada is still king on the very top with most number of online visits. I believe it's 48.4 million online visits, online traffic, and that's followed by Shopee.
That's over the 3 month period, right? 48 million.
Q1,
not okay. Wow.
Q1 2019.
Okay, over 3 months.
That's followed by Shopee with 13.7 million and 11th Street at 13.2 million. So the interesting thing here is that actually Shopee has come out to second place already and has bumped 11th Street off the second place. But more interestingly, also Shopee has also. They measure it differently, so that's by number of visitors. They also break it down by the number of visits to the their online mobile platforms. So in terms of mobile platforms, now it shows that actually Shopee is leading in the highest ranked mobile shopping app since December 2017.
Mobile
shopping app, and that's that is followed by Lazada, 11th Street, and Zalora. So mobile is such a big factor into how people are shopping these days. But desktop as well, you shouldn't discount that as well. But it's interesting that Shopee being at number two in terms of daily of visits, yet they are number one in terms of mobile apps. So I don't know how closely matched they are, but in terms of number of visitors, there's no question that the Alibaba backed Lazada is going to be king of the crop at the moment. So it's very hard to top that, I would say.
It's quite a big difference, right? 48% and 13%. Initially, the top
48.4 million and 13.2 million.
So it's a big visitors. Difference in terms of
it's very big. But in mobile apps, mobile visits, and there's no indication of the figures here.
Okay. Right.
But there's just going by ranking alone.
Okay. I just want to move on to another one of your stories, and this is the first non-Silicon Valley associated accelerator in Malaysia, and it's from China.
Yes.
Right.
Interesting.
Tell me.
So Toastar is actually an incubator. Professional incubator from China. They were brought over to the Selangor Accelerator Program, the inaugural Selangor Accelerator Program that was launched last Friday. Toastar, they originally came from Tsinghua University in Beijing, and actually they were part of their science park, but they have branched out, and now they have about 100 over incubators across China and 5,000 over startups that they've invested in alumni, and that's just in China alone. I didn't quite get to know how much was the. I think they more or less, sorry, the figure that they gave me was 27 million yuan. I can't remember how much that is in US dollars, but that's the amount, 27 billion yuan. I might get the numbers wrong.
What's that in ringgit? By two or something?
No, it's quite different.
But
they obviously have lots of years of experience. I think they've been started from 1999. So there's
1999,
So almost 20 years of experience and lots of investments and stuff. So they bring, that is the that's what they bring to the table. And the top 30 startups that were selected at the SAP, Shanghai Accelerator Program, were present there in their, at their center in Shah Alam. So these 30 startups were come from a variety of backgrounds, from AI, from retail, from fashion, from a whole lot of different retail, different backgrounds. And the top 10 of them will actually get a chance to go to Tsinghua University in Beijing sometime in the middle of this year. Mm. So the exchange there will be a knowledge exchange, and they'll be able to also have a chance to pitch to us, Chinese investors as well. Adding to that, I forgot to mention that Two Star also revealed that, you know, they are very open to helping Malaysian startups to, you know, enter the Chinese market, because there's a lot of complexities entering the Chinese market. Yes. You have a lot of government regulations which they are familiar with, and then you also have, if the regulations come in, the familiarity of the laws, and then they say they even help them out in helping the source for human resources in China, as well as R&D as well. So, okay. I mean, it's the whole breadth of things that all you could want in a startup.
Okay, it's not Stanford in Silicon Valley, Xinhua. Where in China?
Beijing.
No, in Xinhua, I think it's one of the world's top 15 ranked universities, right? So it's a premier university in China. Yeah, so the pedigree is there. Interesting. Yeah.
They're not an unknown quantity.
They got into my radar over a decade ago. I said, hey, what's this university out?
SAP, not to be confused with the other Selangor Accelerator Program. Yeah. All right, we'll continue with other stories after the Bursa update. Stay tuned to Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Enterprise. Frida Liu here, Chong Jin Seung, Karamjit Singh, and Zof Azmi from Digital News Asia, sharing stories in the tech ecosystem. And Zof, you've got this is the first global online data hackathon, and with a team from a local university, emerging champions.
Yes. So this was a story. Well, I was at University of Malaya last Saturday before this datathon ended. First, to give a bit of background, the Datathon was organized by this organization called the Data Science Society, which is an organization based in Europe, and it's a very loose affiliation of data scientists. I think they have like 100 data scientists who are members. And one of the things they do, obviously, is they organize this thing called a Datathon. And the difference between a Datathon and a Hackathon fundamentally is that with a Datathon, the task is to take a lot of data, big data if you like, real life data, and then build a tool that can extract knowledge out of that big data. So what happened was there were universities from Bulgaria, universities from Hungary, I believe, Qatar, India, and then obviously University of Malaya from Malaysia. They spent the whole weekend clearly not sleeping, hopefully showering in between. Their expectations were modest. I think they hoped to reach the semifinals, but at the end of the weekend, they came out top.
Yay! Were you surprised?
Well, simply because when I talked to to the adults, as it were, they were all quite, we think we're quite good, but we don't know how good they are. So this I guess was a chance to sort of measure themselves.
Okay.
I mean, you must. So I talked to Sharala Axrit.
Sharala. Okay. All right,
I struggle with her last name.
Axrit.
Yeah, right. And she was there, and obviously CAD's
Center for Data Science.
She was clearly involved, as she's involved in anything in this nature in the country. And I also talked to
she asked me to turn up. I didn't go. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, well.
You're admitting this on live radio.
Ooh, data science. Yeah, go on.
And they were, I suppose, when you talk to them about data science, the passion clearly spills over. And they're very excited about the future of data science in Malaysia. I mean, not just because it's in high demand in industry, but because they feel that it's an untapped thing where you don't have to be a computer science student to move into data science.
And the figure that's been bandied around, like 20,000 data scientists needed by 2020.
Yeah. I think the use of the word scientist, will, for us from the older generation, you recoil from that because you know how difficult, and you know, it's like trying to getting a PhD, right? Scientist, yeah. So very difficult. So data executive, I'm comfortable with that. So because I was saying that, I think I've said on air also that if I end up losing my job, okay, and I want to look for a career that has upside, I would actually go and take a data executive, program that equip me with those skills. And then coincidentally, I found out that somebody I spoke to had recommended to their colleague, you know, whose daughter wasn't sure what she wanted to do, to, hey, consider data science. And then the daughter is actually enrolling in a 2-year data science program, yeah, in a local university. But interesting enough, according to this girl's mother, there was only one university she could find that had data science program. But Sharala actually sent me a PDF where there's a list of local universities here that do offer that. So even because it's so new, the information about that is not very deep yet out there. But there's definitely more than one university that offers data science. And by the way, University of Malaya is going to offer that next year, right?
Yes. Because at the moment, data science is integrated into their normal computer science program. Yeah. But starting from next year, they'll do a Bachelor of Science in Data Science. So it's a specialist course, correct, on the which shows you how seriously I think people are taking this.
It should, but it's future proof, right? I mean, as a parent, what more could you want, right? Your child is taking, it's going to be the law, the medicine, the accounting, you know, all wrapped into one. If anyone, as people get to know it more, when you say a child is doing a data science, they say, oh, you're set, man. Don't worry about AI and, you know, waves or robotics coming.
I mean, the other thing I need to add is, I mean, they were literally, the team was one master's student, the rest were undergraduates. Mm. So it was like, you know, they had mentors. Mm. And then,
of course, all the students would have in the other countries also, right? So no yes, unusual, no unfair advantage from the same team, yeah.
They're meant to have mentors.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And the other thing was, the part of the objective was they also wanted the different teams to interact with one another. So they went online and chat. Although I don't know how much they interacted, but they're meant to.
Yeah, so kudos to the Malaysian team. And you know where you stand on a global stage,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Malaysia
and
Boleh.
Kudos to both the students that you quoted, you know, said that we were glad we were able to apply the knowledge we had picked up. So credit to the, you know, computer science program at University of Malaya also for giving them the raw tool, the base foundation ready to build on, right? Mm. Awesome.
I mean,
in
the article published on DNA, if anyone's interested to know more, then there's a link to the paper they published and a video of them giving the presentation. Yeah. And although I'm not a big data scientist, what I saw was like, okay, this looks very interesting.
Pretty cool,
okay,
yeah?
I just want to move on to a story with you, Karen, before we talk about another thing, but about AI and how we need to temper our expectations of the speed of its impact.
I think because like last week and the week before, there was just a plethora.
Well,
all right. First time I'm using that word on there, I'm excited, man. A plethora of news, you know, about AI. Universities offering it, an accelerator. I think one of the global companies has set up an AI-based accelerator. Obviously, unfortunately, in Singapore, not in Malaysia. But McKinsey comes up with a research, you know, about how AI is going to be a big, you know, all the various use cases of AI. And then HSBC Bank came up with a global research on some of the key disruptions that are happening now and going to happen. And the thumbprint of AI, you know, was all over this, you know. And I say, wow. But then luckily, I read a piece, and I say lucky because I read a piece. Edwin wrote a very good piece about chatbots, about how, you know, you need to start exploring chatbots, but you know, you don't need to rush into it and make sure there's a real business need for you to do that. It's a very good article, you should read that. But what I found was that you give an example of DG, they're already using a chatbot. And a DG executive said that, because you think chatbots, then they self-learn, right? Because there's elements of artificial intelligence coded into them, and then they learn from the requests, you know, from people, and then they build that user knowledge base. It says that self-learning can only happen after you've trained the chatbot well with the right information. So you still have to train the chatbot. It's not learning on its own. And also within a limited chatbot, it said that within a limited context, right, that a chatbot or the one that you're using can infer certain things. For example, a customer asks about international roaming, it knows that your probably next question is going to be about roaming rates, right? Mm. But that's probably the limit to what it can infer. So that's reassuring for us. They're not going to come and just take over everything very fast. It is moving fast. Especially in military, I think there was a quick headline I saw that the U.S. Army and the U.S. military and Google have worked on an AI tool that can teach, is already knows how to program, write software itself.
Yes.
And I think the most advanced users are in the military. And, you know, of course, the Chinese military and the Russian military, they're not going to share the advances they have, right? But, you know, there's a real fierce race going on there to be dominant in that space. And but at this level, at the consumer level, at the main market level, I think it's not moving as fast as sometimes we inadvertently, you know, give the impression that, hey, you know, day after tomorrow, AI is here, you know, everyone can pack up and go back to Penang or some island Pangkor and, you know, chill and drink coconut juice.
No, I mean, not happening tomorrow.
Yeah, not happening. Not happening day after tomorrow, too. It is coming, but not that fast. Zoff,
Karamji
have a
talking,
dissenting view?
I could have a dissenting view. I was going to agree with you first, dissent.
Then dissent, okay.
Remind
me doing appraisal, yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to keep quiet. No, Karamjit talked about defense, using it in as part of defense, right? In an article that will hopefully come out next week, I talked to Threat Metrics, and they said, on the one hand, AI is being used to protect your computers against viruses now. Mm-hmm. There's now a slew of threat detection that uses AI to identify threats. But they said, we also know that the bad guys on the other side are using AI to develop better viruses.
Yes.
So you are in real time seeing, I guess, a cyber war being run by computers in developing, it's like an arms race, building stronger and stronger weapons, and it's AI that's developing the attacks and defense, which then brings to mind the Terminator movies and... You take a step back. The thing I wanted to sort of maybe disagree with Karam a bit about is that AI in many ways AI is actually very easy though, because you let it work on the problem.
Yeah.
So you're right, you need a learning set, but if you can get a good learning set and if you can teach, I call it teaching good from bad or teaching taste. Mm. If the AI can judge, oh, this is something good and this is not good, then you sort of leave it to work by itself, and sometimes you'd be surprised with what they come up with. It's, I mean, obviously there's a whole field of study.
So just to one quick point, you know, AI really is the umbrella term, okay? Mm. And under AI, you've got subfields such as, you know, robotics, you know, machine learning, machine vision, expert system, general intelligence, and natural language processing, and then chatbots are mixed in there also. So AI is the umbrella term.
Okay. Now, next weekend, there's going to be the latest startup conference in town.
Oh, yeah, man.
Is there really a need for another one?
Exactly. Very good question. Because, you know, when Inbarat Supia, who's organizing this, you know, said he's organizing one and he wanted DNA to be involved, I say, hey, bro.
Oh, I'm speaking there.
You're speaking there. Is there a need? Come on, man. You're obviously overbooked, okay?
What's your topic, Fiza?
Yes, they do.
shall we change the subject now?
Yeah, exactly. No, Frida is this. So there's a sense of legitimacy la. There's obviously a need, because otherwise Frida would have said no.
Because I just asked him, I was like, hey, is this still happening next week? And he says yes. I said, oh, okay. And so it was just a question that I asked.
No, but fantastic. Since he approached DNA not 2 months ago, he's done a fantastic job of building. It's over 2 days, very ambitious. Any conference you want to do. And very interesting people are speaking. And what I
good
like
luck
is...
to him.
Yeah, you should. No, and what I like about what Inbarat has done, he said that this conference also gives a chance for people in the local ecosystem to get to know the more successful entrepreneurs in our ecosystem itself. So, you know, for us as journalists, we meet the guys like Bikesh and Kylie or Chen Chao and Joel from Fave and all these guys, you know... who is this? Carl Lu from Service Hero Tam Keng Yu. I could go on and on, but we meet them all the time, right? So we think it's easy to have access to them. But for the rest of those who are just starting out, whatever, I think you're right. It's difficult to meet these people or you get intimidated because, you know, you think they're doing well. All of these guys don't think they're doing well yet, right? They want to be earning over 100 million ringgit in revenue, not in the millions that they're doing now. But so that's a good point he made, that I want to bring, you know, local ecosystem newbies, you know, to get to know some of the more mature figures there. So very, very good lineup of speakers there. And, you know, it's...
Frida Liu, I hear, is pretty good too.
We don't know about that. I think there were some weak speakers I heard loud again, but I won't identify who they are.
We'll let them prove themselves.
Yeah.
But it's interesting Karam said that because obviously plugging Digirati 50, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the objectives that I think you can expound on this, that one of the objectives of Digirati 50 is to let people know the breadth of... entrepreneurs that exist here in Malaysia.
Exactly.
And that there are people doing very interesting stuff. And as Karim said, yeah, some of them will be hugely successful and some of them might not be. But the fact is we do have a diverse ecosystem here.
People are trying. So it's going to be a great, I think, 2-day event. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, you are speaking there, Frida, and you know, we are the media partner, you know. And I'm going to be, I think I'm moderating a panel also. So I better make sure I'm free on that day, man, which I am. But so he's done a great job. And I think, you know, so the point here is, you know, never, and I'm glad I didn't discourage him, but, you know, never be a wet blanket on someone, you know, who wants to try to do something. Maybe they can do it in a better way, right? Because there's so many startup conferences, and this just adds to another one. And by the way, Exabytes is coming up, having their annual e-commerce conference coming up, but that's specifically on e-commerce.
And this would be very interesting because we're after the elections as well.
So there'll be a lot of, you know, sub-talking points that I think the coffee tete-tete conversations will be very heated and interesting. Yeah.
Okay.
So good job to him, you know.
So you're going to wrap up with the Digirati 50 profile on Anthony Tan, of course, and his $1 billion monetization challenge.
When we wrote this, and of course we had to feature him, right? He's raised too much money not to be featured. He was our Digirati from the last edition, but we featured him again because he has this monetization challenge, right? You've raised a few billion US dollars. Your valuation is like, you know, 6 billion or whatever. And now you got to prove it, right? You got to show me the money now, the investors are saying. So that's going to be a huge challenge for him. And that's why we featured him against Digirati. And, you know, the merger with, you know, it's a merger, you know, M&A with Uber.
That's right.
Is one path of eliminating a competitor, right? Although they have a stake in you, now they have a vested interest in your success. And, you know, he's got his own Grab Pay also. And you can see all the billboards. You know,
and do you know that the company is only going to be 5 years old in June?
Yeah, because we featured them in they actually, Frida, they launched in 2012. One of the first articles DNA did when we launched, you know, in May of 2012.
Well, so it's only 6 years.
Yeah, 6 years. Yeah. And actually, by the way, we are almost 6 years old next week, man. Amazing. May 14, DNA is 6 years old. So we've survived that long. So So this guy, one of our early articles was on them. So it's kind of interesting. He's got big challenges still, right? And then he's one time, I think, a Harvard Business School classmate, Nadia Makarim, coincidentally, who's now running Gojek. So he's going to be a big competitor of Gojek. And everyone here in the room is in the studio shaking, nodding their heads, yes? Mm. That's going to be a big competition coming. And we also speculate whether Gojek is going to come to Malaysia. Some people told me they don't think so because it's very a motorbike first-driven service. And then we're not a culture where you have a lot of motorbikes and dispatch, you know, you dispatch drivers, but they don't think it will work because our infrastructure is too good. Because you can easily get around with cars and MRTs and public transport. So there's a smaller pain point for Gojek to come and make Malaysia a beachhead. They may definitely Vietnam, Philippines and Thailand. And even Singapore now, surprisingly. But Singapore is because after Uber left, they're partnering, they're trying to talk to the taxi company that Uber had partnered with, and you have access to suddenly a fleet of 10,000 over cars. So that may happen.
Let's read up on Anthony Tan.
Exactly, on DNA. That story comes out tomorrow. That article. Okay. It's already in our Digirati 50. You can download the whole thing now on the website. Otherwise, read the individual article that comes out tomorrow.
All right. Thanks for being with us, Chong Jin Siong, Karamjit Singh, and Zul Azmi from Digital News Asia. You've been listening to Enterprise BFM 89.9.
Chakaday.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.